processor to suppress the clicks, ticks, and pops. What remains is chiefly a relatively steady and relatively lower pitch sounding hiss. And so we now have a continuous noise suppressor which goes after the hiss, and Tom is going to tell you about that.
Now this is a block diagram of the continuous noise suppressor, abbreviated CNS. Oh, I'm sorry.
Okay, that's better. Okay,
that's a block diagram of the continuous noise suppressor, abbreviated CNS, of which there's a signal path, which is the upper line, and then also a second path, which determines whether corner frequencies should be high to pass high harmonic contents in 3 kilohertz to 15 kilohertz range, or close down on the basis that there is not harmonic content. The decision-making process basically takes place in a comparator circuit where audio signal is examined in the 1.7 kilohertz to 3.4 kilohertz range. If there is audio signal within that range, the circuit automatically assumes that there is high frequency content in the form of harmonics greater than 3 kilohertz that must be saved. And in this action, then the corner frequency moves upward in response to the music, and it's a continually varying effect. The basic corner frequency then has a roll-off of about 8 to 10 decibels per octave. We find that this kind of a gradual slope compared to a steep slope, as is commonly available, gives a less subtle operation that can be compensated for in an octave equalizer or a third octave equalizer if necessary. That to go to 20 decibels gives a more abrupt operation, which can be known as pumping, I guess is the phrase known in the industry. So that basically is the continuous noise suppressor. I guess with that, do you have any questions?
Two questions. How would your noise suppressor treat Mozart's Surprise Symphony? Or Haydn's Surprise Symphony?
I don't know if it's a specific recording, I guess, that you're referring to. Dick and I both have fairly large collections of 78s and LP records. And I can say that just on casual listening to a variety of records that go back from the acoustic era to the...
What I'm referring to specifically is that there is a long, quiet passage for fundamentally the whole piece of music, and then a terrific
And that type of music in general, the blanker comes into its own. You remember that there was that surfboard effect, and the effect is that the surfboard actually comes right down to zero when there's no music, so that the least amount of transient just completely gets wiped out. When there is a music signal, the surfboard potential rises in response to the average signal, and then clips transient noise that exceeds the music signal. So it quiets it substantially.
My other question, and of course I forgot to bring along the record I wanted you to play to test this. How does it work on spoken records?
Spoken records are also very effective. We find that with spoken record, there seems to be a lot of burst and then quiet, and that in this range, the periods of silence are quite closed down. It makes the intelligibility of speech quite superior. Yes.
On music we just heard, the Benny Goodman and so on, in non-technical terms, if you please, it seems to me you lost a great deal of the original presence. While you did cut down on the noise of the disc, you lost all the vitality of the performance. Can you compensate for that?
Yes. There's quite a versatility of settings, and we approximately set them for the acoustics of this room. But the amount of action, whether the closing down effect is severe to get rid of noise, to improve intelligibility, or the musical nature of the signal, you can do that. Our general approach was to design the controls so that we save the music. We preferred saving music over loss of fidelity or of the music content. And the controls have been set up accordingly.
I would like to say this, that sometimes on initial listening, there's so much high frequency energy in the surface noise that when you switch the unit out, you think you've lost fidelity in the music you really have. If the person who asked the question, if you care to come up afterwards, after this is over, would you have to place a few more records in this unit to convince yourself as to whether or not we are losing the music?
Yeah, I just wonder.
Yes, we'll set up later in our room for demonstrations. We'll be set up in
the 625.
We can demonstrate you the seats.
Yeah.
We've got a variety of
records,
and if you have any,
put
yours on.
Yeah.
25.
Do you have spoken records?
Yes, I have
spoken records. I just want to reiterate the thing that Dick said. We've been using the Pacburn in our laboratory for a couple of years now. One of the things that we've noticed, to answer the other gentleman's question, is that when the noise goes away, you tend to think that you're losing high frequencies, but if you measure that, you're not always. Sometimes you can if you use it improperly. The thing that tends to happen is your ear is excited by a lot of high frequency energy, which is primarily noise in a lot of cases. So when it disappears, you think you've lost the high frequencies, but in effect you haven't. Now, if you don't use it properly, it certainly can be misused, and then you would indeed lose presence in high frequencies.
I can also add to that that there are three stages in the operation of the machine. The transient noise suppressor stage is the blanker and the switcher. It's our belief that there's no loss of fidelity regardless of how the settings are made. The continuous noise suppressor, by virtue of getting after the hiss components, the high frequency continuous components of noise, can cause some loss of a signal if the corner's frequency is set low.
But I should add that it does need a high frequency boost before the device itself sees the signal, and that signal then has to be converted at the end of it to remove that high frequency boost. I don't know whether you've done that yet or not. And that it does work very well with equalization.
Yes.
I'd like to ask you about use of tape. It reacts differently if you take that very same record, make a two-track tape of it, and play it back into it to the TNS. It will the switcher section reacts differently in terms of taking out the ticks.
Well, I think Dick maybe could comment on that more than I could. The alignment of the head is very important on tape playback, so that the two channels that you're feeding in from whatever the original signal, or whether it was a record or whatever, that those two tracks must be concurrent. Yes, is Dick?
Yeah, but I'm talking about, you know, a tape recorder that's been set up, you know, properly and so forth.
Well, I like to hear what you
say. Also, I already spoke to him about this, but I'd like to bring it up here. The use of a digital delay in when you have, let's say, you have some tape that's a mono tape, quarter track, both directions, which we get a lot in archive business. You want to, it's got a lot of ticks on it, and you'd like to use it with the Pacburn. Since it would be useless to split the signal and send it through, because the switcher section wouldn't work, could you split it, delay one side, just slightly, send it through the switcher section,
No, that wouldn't work. What you really need is the redundancy of signals where you have equal audio signal, differing noise content. And maybe it's one strong remark we'd like to make is that in the recording of old records for preservation, that it seems to us to be very important to record all these stereophonically, whether by this particular device or devices in the future, that it does give another means for removing noise inherent to that recording.
But you're saying that it wouldn't work?
It wouldn't work, the switcher would not work from a monaural tape.
No, I know that, but what if you took it and split the signal digitally and fed it a two-track signal into the input?
Well, then what you'd have is switching action on the delayed audio signal as well as the noise, and you get kind of a funny chopped effect.
Yes, I thought about that. We talked about on the phone. And if you tried a stereo, if you tried to switch it on a stereo record, I think you have the same kind of chopped up effect.
Mm-hmm.
We're gonna try.
Okay.
Yeah. But I would say my hopes wouldn't be too high.
What about running in tandem, using a delay and running in tandem, two of them? Would that work?
I don't believe it would.
At some point, maybe you could try that?
Yeah, we can give a thought.
Uh-huh. Twice. Right. I'm very sorry. We're going to have one more paper. Thank you very much. Thank you, Tom. Thank you. Finally, this afternoon, Art Schifrin's work, Art, as many of you know, I believe, is an independent engineering consultant, audio consultant. He has been doing some specialization work recently, or over the recent years, in early recordings. Art is not able to be with us today because of personal commitments elsewhere. Instead, Tim Brooks, who is the second vice president of the association, and I don't think probably anyone else has mentioned it, and I'll take this opportunity to do it, to give you a little more background on Tim, if you don't know him. He's the director of network television research for NBC, and he's the co-author of a new book, our recent book, called The Complete Directory of Primetime Network TV Shows. Tim?
The paper I'm going to read you was given to me Tuesday evening, so I'm afraid I will not be able to answer questions on it. I can simply present to you what Mr. Schifrin gave to me. He sends his extreme regrets, by the way. It was a very last-minute, unfortunate circumstance that he couldn't be here. Art Schifrin had been scheduled to talk here today and to demonstrate his new electrical cylinder reproducing system. He was unable to come, but did prepare some slides and tapes for us. Before we hear and see this system, I've been asked to discuss the special services which Art has been providing for clients such as the Country Music Foundation and the Rodgers and Hammerstein Archives. As you know, sound archives have very special requirements for tape recording and playback equipment. These include an ability to contend with any format and speed, capability for speed correction without degradation of wow and flutter, convenient and accurate confirmation of speed, and a fail-safe tape handling system on which accidental erasure and tape stretching or breaking are as unlikely as technically possible. Concurrent to the need for more sophisticated and reliable equipment are the severe financial pressures of inflation, high interest rates, and budgetary cutbacks. As a result of inflation, the prices of new equipment, which is not necessarily best suited to archival uses, have driven more potential users into the market for used equipment. Older tape systems have therefore especially greatly increased in value. Art has recognized these factors and developed modifications for professional recorders, especially Ampex and Scully. It is his opinion that especially the Ampex 350s and 440s are inherently reliable and desirable instruments, and that it is better to modify and rejuvenate them to meet specific needs of an archives than to pay very high prices for new recorders. In addition to providing rejuvenation services for typical problems such as rebuilding head assemblies and other commonly worn parts, Art can take a derelict transport and rebuild it to meet the needs of the re-recording laboratory. May I have the first slide, please? This was a somewhat dilapidated Ampex AG445B reproducer. It has been redesigned as a fail-safe reproducer on which erasure is impossible because only playback electronics are utilized. The system has the latest Ampex DC servo capstan system, which has been modified for four-speed operation, that is 3 3/4, 7.5, 15, and 30. The speeds are selected by the four-speed rotary switch, which replaces the two-position toggle in the lower left-hand corner. Variable speed is accomplished with the VS10 variable speed oscillator at the top of the electronics. This special head assembly has three playback heads, full track, two-track stereo, and four-track quad. This machine can therefore play full track, half track stereo or mono, and quarter track quad stereo or mono tapes at any speed between 1.5 and 45 inches per second. This shot shows the head assembly in detail. Each of the three heads is housed in a mu metal cup for maximum shielding from hum-causing magnetic fields. From left to right are the full track, two track, and four track heads. The quad head is particularly important for contending with old full track tapes whose oxides are flaking. Much like swerving down a pothole-filled road to avoid the disruptions, the engineer can greatly diminish or eliminate dropouts by selecting which part of a given section of tape is to be played. This technique was used extensively by Art in a project just completed for CBS, working for paperback tapes of club date performances by Charlie Parker. Going back to the original illustration, each of the three heads has its own set of modified reproduce electronics, either Ampex or Innovonix. The levels and equalizations for each head, and up to three speeds, and with the Innovonix 376, two speeds with the Ampex playback card, can be optimally adjusted without the usable compromises, which must be made when two or more heads are switched to one set of electronics. The mechanical operation of the transport has been updated with the addition of constant holdback tension using the Innovonix Tentrol. This eliminates the erroneous speed reductions which occur toward the end of the tape pack. Because it reduces tension at the end of the reel, it also reduces tape skewing and head wear on the older machines, which occur on the older machines. Tape can be ruined by prematurely entering the play mode from fast forward or rewind on the older machines, that is. If the tape has not stopped moving when the pinch roller bottoms, then stretching or breaking will result. The addition of motion sensing prevents this from occurring. When the play button is pressed, the play instruction is stored and will not take effect until the tape has been stopped for an appropriately brief period. With this modification, play can be entered directly from fast forward or rewind without use of the stop button. Preliminary versions of this modification were installed in the 4350s in the public service section of the Rodgers and Hammerstein archive some months ago. These units were continually damaging tape because they were operated via remote control by non-professionals, the public, in other words, from listening booths. Since their installation, not one tape has been damaged. Not shown in this photograph is a digital speed readout which monitors the operation of the capstan motor and provides easy speed accuracy tests and speed confirmations and computations. Now, all of the modifications shown here can be installed into 350 and 440 transports. 350s modified with these changes are capable of producing tapes which can rival the quality of the finest analog units now being sold. The 440 is especially recommended for reproduction-only applications because of the ease of editing. Now we have two illustrations of the cylinder system designed by Mr. Schifrin. This one is shown playing a standard 2-minute indestructible. The Stanton 310B preamp is shown on top of the motor controls housing. On production models, the preamp will be mounted directly on the base in front of the enclosure. The modified Rabco SL8E arm is controlled by the three toggle switches on top of the motor housing from left to right. from left to right, you see the servo override, the lift, and the mute. The arm elevator mount is supplied when different size mandrels are required. The concert mandrel is at the left side of the arm, and to its right, a 6-inch dictaphone cylinder. Here is the same apparatus shown playing the Columbia Grand Concert cylinder, or a Columbia Grand Concert cylinder, which is on the tape. Art has prepared a tape demonstrating the typical results he has achieved with various types of cylinders. And I might add that I don't think we'll be able to play all of these, but we'll give you excerpts from a few of them with a statement first of what the original source material was, of course. These have been supplied by Alan Koenigsberg from the Antique Phonograph Monthly Collection. The samples follow roughly the evolution of the cylinder recording technology, starting with commercially issued brown wax cylinders. It is important to remember that the first three samples are very likely pantographically made copies, and therefore their potential fidelity is rather limited. First example is the Village Blacksmith, Edison number 630, by the Edison Military Band, recorded at 120 RPM, and the original was in excellent condition. It's from about 1896. The second example, in my old Westchester home among the maples, Columbia cylinder by Will F. Denny, also 120 RPM, recorded approximately 1899. And the original, although again it may very well be a pantograph copy, the original was in excellent condition. But for the next cylinder, he apologizes at this point for some of the racial contents of some of these. They're being exhibited here, obviously, for technical purposes. The next cylinder is My Tiger Lily by the Columbia Grand, a Columbia Grand Concert Cylinder by George J. Gaskin. Again, 120 RPM, approximately 1899. There was incipient mold on this original with groove wear visible. Those three cylinders predated molding technology and represent the most primitive types of commercial recordings. The breakthrough by Lambert in 1899 of the molding process enabled much better fidelity, providing master quality in mass-produced copies. The next example is the Cornfield Medley by the American Quartet on Lambert number 594. It's one of the pink flexible celluloid cylinders, recorded at 144 RPM, in excellent condition, as they fortunately usually are, made approximately 1901. It does a bit, but I'm not sure. It's a tricky area. Edison's response to the Lambert process was the gold molded 2-minute black wax cylinder, which was introduced in 1902. The next example is Darkey Tickle by Ruby Brooks, Edison number 2608, remake obviously, circa 1904. The original is in excellent condition, recorded at 160 RPM. This is an excellent solo instrumental recording for this period.
Banjo solo, Darkey Tickle, played by Mr. Ruby Brooks of Brooks and Delta, made on record.
The first celluloids had no reinforcing centers, so they were flexible and precariously fragile. The indestructibles had cardboard centers with metal rings on each end. The celluloid adjacent to the rings often shrink on these, creating radical depressions and elevations which are difficult to track. This kind of problem is handled very easily by the half-speed transfer technique. The cylinder is so warped that at its normal playing speed, the arm bounces uncontrollably. It was transferred at 80 RPM with a linear phono preamplification. The tape was recorded at 7.5 IPS and reproduced at 15. Signal processing was done from playback of the master. The cylinder is Blitz and Blatz at the Seashore by Dupre and Roberts, an indestructible 1160 made about 1908 in somewhat less than excellent condition. We'll play the whole thing for you later if you'd like. Again, that was recorded at half speed because at full speed it simply won't track. The first finer pitch cylinders were issued by Edison in 1908. These 4-minute records have 200 grooves per inch instead of the previous standard, which was 100. I'm not sure about that. Until 1912, these were made of extremely brittle black wax and should be handled with extreme care. The first example of the 4-minute wax Edison cylinder is Knock Wood by Sophie Tucker on 4-minute number 852, recorded at Edison standard of 160 RPM. The original was in approximately new condition, except for a blemish, which is audible, made about January 1912.
He was a pretty little miss. He
It's a rare cylinder if you ever find a copy of that. The next example is a recording of Theodore Roosevelt. It was taken from a Blue Ambrol reissue of a 4-minute wax cylinder. Its level is low, even by 1911 standards, so the signal-to-noise ratio is poor. However, the rendition of the voice is extremely natural. The selection is The Farmer and the Businessman on Edison 3708, again 160 RPM, the original in excellent condition. We note that this system is also designed to play dictaphone cylinders, which physically resemble the standard groove 6-inch cylinders issued briefly after 1900. Their speed is usually about 80 RPM, so the fidelity has limited potential. The first archival application of this system was for the motion picture and sound recording branch of the U.S. National Archives. For them, Art transferred approximately 100 dictaphone cylinders of off-the-air recordings made by the Navy Department of shortwave transmissions. These were mostly propaganda broadcasts from Germany and Japan, dating from the late 1930s to early 1940s. This is an interesting example of anti-British propaganda aimed at listeners in the U.S. The specific example here is OK Speaking, July 16, 1940. The condition of the original is cracked, but otherwise the surface is excellent. And the number, if you're interested, is number 200-1121.
And this is OK Speaking. OK Speaking. Confidentially, when did you see the last motion picture? I mean, the last drama motion picture. Probably you didn't see any drama films since 1933. I know that there are a few million German theaters in some of the largest cities in America, but the American motion picture houses did not show a single German picture since the National Socialist Revolution, as far as I know. Not that there were no German pictures. In fact, there have been a great many, and many excellent ones. But, you know, on account of the American boycott, none of these German pictures got a chance on the American screen.
In summary, this new cylinder system enables electrical reproduction of virtually all formats of cylinders, with results superior to those achieved by alternate methods. Recordings having musical, historical, cultural, and anthropological value can be preserved properly. This is especially important because many cylinders, especially wax ones, have a finite shelf life. One more important capability remains to be exploited, the Edison kinetophone films, whose acoustically recorded soundtracks were electromechanically synchronized to their picture components, and these have, in Art's opinion, never been properly reproduced. The synchronizing technology which Art has developed for use on Vitaphone soundtrack discs can be also applied to this type of recording. The results could finally be sonically and visually correct. Art is interested in collaborating with an institutional sound or film archive to accomplish this unusual restoration proposal. It would, of course, necessitate the full cooperation of the Edison Historic Site. I would point out that copies of a brochure describing Art's equipment in detail are down by the entrance here and free if you'd like to pick one up. Thank you.
Sure, can I make one comment?
I wish it brief.
Okay, I wish that Art was here, but I think one of the things that has to be pointed out while we have brochures and equipment to look at is that we have seen a system that is proving that you can play a cylinder with an electronic stylus, an apparatus. I have not seen any proof from an archival point of view, and this is what I would like to see in the future for these kind of demonstrations, what is the accuracy of this kind of a system. I think that is equally important because I think it's very easy to sit down and enjoy that, which I enjoyed, I'm sure, as much as everyone else did. But I think that from an archival point of view, I think that in the future it would be good to justify the reproduction system that somebody is proposing. That's all. Thank you.
I didn't find out until I sat down after introducing Tim. His book has just recently won the American Book Award. I thank you to the speakers this afternoon and to Art, who was not here. I wish he had been. I think you and he would have an interesting discussion, Bill, even more so than some of the others we had a few minutes ago. Also to remind you that Dick and Tom have agreed to stay here, passing up the wine and cheese, at least part of it, I think, to give a little more demonstration of their equipment if you wish, and that you can contact them after 8:30 this evening in room 625 at the Elgin Hotel, or Lord Elgin, if you wish to hear more. This is obviously a very brief surface touch of four different directions that preservation, storage, and retrieval of sound are going. I think it's an essential part of an annual conference to keep us each aware of what our colleagues are doing in the field. Thank you for being so attentive.
Donning my other hat, the opening session tomorrow morning is at 9:30. From 8:30 to 9:30, I would remind